We're back with you on The Leader, Dieter Kurtenbach, until noon. We're getting you ready for two big games here. One's happening today, one's happening tomorrow. I'm not sure what the Venn diagram is of people who are super excited about both of these games, but count me as one and count Michael Cohen of Fox Sports as another one. We're talking USA, England, Michigan, Ohio State. Classic 1-2 punch there, Cohen. How you doing, baby?
I'm doing good. How are you, Dieter?
I'm good. Let's talk about the soccer game first. U.S. let one go against Wales. There's no question about that. Just a lifeless performance in the second half. But I thought a pretty encouraging first half. England absolutely whooped up on Iran in their first game. England's prohibitive favorites to win this game or at least get away with a point. I think U.S. is plus 600 to win it. How do you see the U.S. matching up now that we know that the lineup is more or less the same than what we saw against Wales?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would like to see is if they can come out and play with the same kind of aggression and attacking style that they had in the first half of the game against Wales, because you saw that they believed in themselves. They wanted to be on the front foot. They wanted to play nice, attractive, creative soccer, making runs in behind. It wasn't like they were just sitting in and waiting to try and counterattack. And so I think the longer the game remains 0-0, the more likely we are to see, you know, those types of efforts. But I think as soon as you saw, you know, a situation where the U.S. had the lead, or as soon as it was a situation where they needed to go chase the game after the equalizer had come from Wales, you could see the inexperience. You could see that it wasn't a team that knew how to protect the lead. It wasn't a team that, you know, knew how to go and chase a game. And so I just think that, you know, the longer it stays nil-nil, or maybe if the U.S. can squeak one, they just have to continue what they're doing. And the reason I say that is because we've seen some of these games so far in this tournament, like the Saudi Arabia game, where a team that doesn't have as much talent but plays with aggressiveness, plays with assertiveness, has done better than the teams that have just packed it in and sort of just said, okay, well, we'll try and not give up a goal to these teams that are heavy favorites.
And I would like to think that the U.S. is built to, perhaps it's just one route, perhaps they have to go right down the line on the Death Star, but like, I'd like to think that this is a team that if they press and press some more, at least down the middle, I think Bellingham is a really good player. I'm not a big Rice guy, but like he has proven time and time again to be a solid guy. But like I like the possibilities that the U.S. has with their youth, with their speed, with the crispness that they played with against Wales. I like them going up the spine of that British defense, and or the English defense, I should be more specific. Like, I like them against that, but then I got to be also concerned about Tim Reed and Walker Zimmerman with Saka and Sterling out wide. That's a big concern for me. Where do you see it? Do you feel like the U.S. and that aggressiveness that you just mentioned is enough to swing the game sort of away from the English? And we know that they don't have a great amount of belief, right? Like, the doubt sinks in with that squad no matter what the tournament. Or is the speed on the outside and the clinical finishing of Kane such to where it's just, you just got to try to eke out a draw if you can?
You know, I was really hoping to see Brendan Aaronson in this game, because if you're going to press high and you're going to press aggressively, then why not have a guy in there who does that every weekend in the world's best league in England for Leeds? And so when you don't put him in the lineup, and when you don't put Gio Reyna in the lineup, to me, it just doesn't really make a lot of sense. Like, I would be less concerned about having whoever we think can bang in the goals in the middle, and in this case it looks like it's going to be Haji Wright later this afternoon, than I would be trying to get as many of our best players on the field, our most creative players, that we can. Because if you have those players on the field, opportunities are going to come, things are going to happen. But if you're just selecting a guy who you think can get on the end of crosses, and then you're not guaranteeing yourself that you're going to be able to put those crosses in because you're not choosing the most talented wingers that we have or the most talented outside midfielders that we have, I don't really love that. However, I think that any team that has Harry Maguire starting at center back probably is not going to win the World Cup. And, you know, look, it's not a knock on Harry in terms of what he's done in his career. He was tremendous at earlier points in his career. Yes. But I just don't see how he can be reliable enough over the course of the seven games it'll take to win the tournament to where there's not a mistake that's going to happen. So I say that because I think this is a situation where if the U.S. presses high, they could nick a goal, because Harry has shown that his distribution out of the back is not great. And, you know, I also think the inexperience up the spine that you noted is key. You know, Declan Rice is a is a player that has a number of England caps under his belt, but he's still, you know what, under the age of 25, and Bellingham's still a teenager. So, you know, if you can find a way to get at them, whether it's with physicality or just, you know, making them stretched by moving the ball side to side, whatever the case may be, I think there's some options there. But defensively, I'm concerned. I don't love Serginho Dest down the right side. I don't love our combination at center back. You know, Tim Ream deserves a huge tip of the cap for sort of reinventing himself the last 2 years with Fulham after his last run in the Premier League was largely a disaster with the same Fulham team, it should be noted. But, you know, like I said, like you said, I just don't – Harry Kane against the two of them, I don't love it. So I think the best route, in my opinion, would be to press high, because then you make it harder for them to get the ball into the feet of your Sakas and your Phil Fodens and whoever they decide to play out on the wings or sub in on the wings. So make it harder to get the ball there rather than allowing England to get it there and then just bunkering in. That would be my approach anyway.
What did you make of Christian Pulisic? Obviously, we've made a lot of him in the build-up to this, and he is a brilliant player. He did not look brilliant against Wales, and in fact, it got to the point where I, you know, had enough people in the text telling me, like, hey, they got to stop putting him on top of the ball with set pieces. The deliveries were god-awful, and when you are a counter-attacking team that needs to make the most of the limited opportunities you have with a dead ball, the service that he provided in the game against Wales, it was a surefire way to lose 2 points, as it turned out they did. What did you make of his performance, and do you feel like this matchup, again, with Harry Maguire sitting there, and I guess the U.S. is maintaining this 4-3-3, but with an inexperienced midfield, do you feel like this matchup maybe opens up something more for Christian Pulisic? Like, what do you make of him so far, and what do you expect from him moving forward?
I think it's really hard for any player to suddenly come out and A, play 90 minutes after you basically never get those opportunities at Chelsea anymore or very rarely. And then B, not only to have to play 90 minutes, but play a position where, and for a team who is going to be funneling the ball to you as much as possible. You know, if Christian Pulisic hadn't played a lot for Chelsea, but then he was going to play right back or left back for the U.S. team, there's not as much pressure there to perform because you're not funneling the ball to your right back or your left back, but right. Everything has run through him basically in this qualification cycle for the U.S. And so I think there's a tremendous amount of pressure combined with a lack of match sharpness. And, you know, I mentioned it earlier, but you want to talk about delivery on set pieces. That's where I would have loved to see Gio Reyna in this lineup. You know, 100%. He scored some terrific goals for Borussia Dortmund, a couple of them from dead balls directly. He really, really has a nice flighted delivery, and so I think it would have been nice to see him in those situations. I think you're right. I think you take Pulisic off the dead ball situations, take that pressure away from him, and then maybe he can, you know, settle into the flow of the game without thinking that every little thing has to be done by him. You know, again, a Brendan Aaronson can take a free kick too, but yeah, another game where he's not in the lineup. So I don't know. It's tough. I guess I would say that, you know, kind of like Gareth Bale in Wales, I think the passion is always going to be there, even if the club side kind of hasn't really worked the last few years at Real Madrid and then, you know, at LAFC, he wasn't even really on the field. And I guess it's probably the same for Pulisic. You know, the passion and the fire and the work rate are going to be there.
Yeah.
But I just think when you don't have the minutes, it's really hard to be as sharp as the U.S. needs you to be.
If the U.S. loses this game 2-1 with Iran's win this morning, I mean, they would need a win, obviously, against Iran. But, like, is the door still open to them? Run me through the game theory of how they can still advance out of this group stage if they lose this game, albeit by a tight margin.
Well, you know, I saw somebody on Twitter this morning suggest that they should rest all of their players in this game that are already on a yellow card so that they can basically concede a loss today but then have their best chance to beat Iran, whereas if, you know, the Weston McKinneys of the world who are already on a yellow, if they get a second yellow and are suspended for this third game and, you know, maybe we lose 2-1, like you said, but we're going into this game against Iran down 2 or 3 starters, you know, that's not great. So, but I don't necessarily buy into that. I guess what I would say is if they lose 2-1 today, that leaves them on 1 point going into the final game, and a win would still be enough because, you know, Iran would have 2 losses at that point, their opening round loss to England and then a loss to the United States on match day 3. So can they beat Iran? Yeah, they can. But I think Iran plays a style that is going to have to force a U.S. team that, as you noted, plays counterattacking soccer largely on the national stage, especially when they get out of CONCACAF. they're going to bunker in, and they're going to force the U.S. to possess, and they're going to force the U.S. to break teams down. It's probably going to look a lot like the inverse of what today's game is going to look like, where I imagine England is going to have the majority of the possession, and they're going to have to try and unlock this U.S. defense. And I don't know if I trust the U.S. technically to have that ability to link up in the final third with these little intricate passes, the give and goes that can unlock that system. So I think from a scheduling standpoint, it would have been much, much better for the U.S. if they had played Iran today and then had England in the final game, because A, England might not have anything to play for, and B, the U.S. could have already had the 4 points that would likely get them through anyway. So I think from a scheduling standpoint, it really hurts them. I think there's still a possibility, and, you know, for whatever people want to say about the quality or lack thereof of U.S. teams, there's never been a question about how hard they play in the World Cup. I don't think the effort's going to be an issue. It's just a matter of, do they have the skill to break down a team that, you know, was really, really, really stout defensively in the qualifying. I heard a stat, you know, I could be a little bit off on this because I heard it on the TV and can't quite remember, but it was something to the effect of, in 17 qualifying games, Iran gave up 5 or 6 goals at most. And so the 6-2 that they conceded against England was a huge shock relative to what they'd done in the qualification. So they're a good defensive team, barring, you know, sort of an implosion like they had against England. And I think there's a chance, but, you know, if you can get a draw today, life courses through the veins as opposed to, you know, trickling out of them going into the next game.
No question about that. Okay, let's talk about another game, the game. Last year's Ohio State-Michigan matchup, as we talked to the great Mike Cohen of Fox Sports, and we delve more into his area of at least paid expertise, so I love his soccer takes more than about anything else in sports media right now. last year's game was outstanding. This one feels as big as any since the game of the century in 2006. Am I getting the right read on that? You're in the belly of the beast. You got number 2 versus number 3. I know that there's still a Big Ten championship game to be played, but my God, I mean, this feels like a playoff game.
No, it definitely does. And this is huge because, you know, not only did Michigan snap the losing streak last year, but the way that they did it, by basically bullying Ohio State in the trenches on both sides of the ball, running for 197 yards and 5 touchdowns. And on the other side, you know, Aiden Hutchinson setting the single game record since Pro Football Focus started tracking quarterback pressures. He had 15 by himself in that one game last year.
Wow.
And so, you know, it was just a bludgeoning on both sides of the ball. So it wasn't just that, you know, the winning streak was snapped, because that was going to come to an end at some point anyway, but it was the manner that they did it. And so there's some thinking that with Michigan sort of reviving the exact same identity this year that they had last year, which is just lining up and running it, knowing full well that the defense knows full well that they're going to run it. It doesn't matter. We think we're better than you. If they could do that again 2 years in a row, it would be a slight tilt in the rivalry, in that Ohio State has a culture of producing nothing but high draft picks, but can't match the physicality of the lower rated recruits up north. And that will not sit well with fans of the Scarlet and Gray. So they need to win, not only just to get to the Big Ten title game, like you said, and to have that clearer path to the college football playoff, but also to quickly dispel the notion that one team is significantly tougher than the other and can overcome significant disadvantages in recruiting with just sheer will and coaching and technique and fundamentals and all these things. So for Ryan Day, this is a big, big game. And for Jim Harbaugh, if he can win 2 in a row, boy, will that scratch a big itch for him.
Along those same lines, though, I mean, I agree with your assessment. There is a big gap. Ohio State is a 5-star machine, and they do produce an incredible amount of NFL players, and especially at the skill positions. But what has Jim Harbaugh done since he took over at Michigan? It does feel as if that program is sustainable now. And that wasn't something that you could have said, for obvious reasons, at the beginning of his tenure. And I think was still in question going into maybe this game last year. This was the big get over the hump game. But the fact that they are back in the position again this season to go to the playoff, that doesn't feel fluky to me, because it's not as if they have Heisman contenders. It's not as if, I mean, Aiden Hutchinson's a great player, but it's not as if this is one dude taking them over the top, and when he leaves, it's all going to go to hell again. It feels like Michigan has a higher baseline, a significantly higher baseline than they had a couple of years ago, and certainly before Jim Harbaugh arrived. And while it might not be Ohio State's, it's still mighty impressive. What has Jim Harbaugh done to get the program to the point where that baseline is set?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. It really kind of happened within the last 2 years because he did win a decent number of games in his first 4 or 5 years in Ann Arbor, but he wasn't able to beat the good teams, the highly ranked teams, the Ohio States, the Penn States, whoever they were facing in bowl games. His record in bowl games was really, really bad. And so going into last season, he and offensive coordinator Josh Gattis basically just decided, you know what? Let's go and recreate Stanford football at Michigan, and let's run the ball, and let's bring nothing but tight end packages onto the field and just say, look, we're going to get so good at this one thing that a lot of teams in college football don't do anymore as offenses drift more and more toward spread systems or air raid systems or just, you know, offenses that throw it 30, 35, 40, 45 times.
Big 12 nonsense football. Let's call it what it is.
Exactly, exactly. So he said, screw that. And said, well, we're just going to run it 50 times a game, and we're going to get so good at run blocking, and our offensive line is going to become so in sync that we don't even care if you know that we're going to run it, because we're still just going to be better than you. And, I mean, they have done it. And so their run-pass balance is pretty crazy. You know, they're in the top 10 in rushing attempts for teams this season, and they're in the bottom 15, I believe it is, for passing attempts this season. But both of their running backs, Blake Corum and Donovan Edwards, Blake Corum, I believe, is at 5.1 yards a carry and Donovan Edwards at 6.7 yards a carry over, like I said, a top 10 sample size in the country this year in terms of carries. So it's just basically smash mouth football. And it's Harbaugh to a T, because if you were to sit down with him and say, Jim, you know, if you could go out and win any game you wanted, how would you win the game? It wouldn't be his quarterback throwing for 550 yards and his receivers dancing all over the field. It would be going into it would just be going into the trenches and smashing another guy in the face mask and saying, we're bigger than you, we're tougher than you, we want it more than you, and now you're going to submit to our will. And so I think that's basically what he's done. And so your point about them having a higher floor than they had before is spot on. The corollary to that is, I think while they have a higher floor, they also have a lower ceiling, because I don't know if this offense can beat a Georgia, can beat an Alabama, not this year's Alabama, but most years Alabama. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they would match up against the Tennessee. Now, Tennessee's defense was bad, but can they match up to an offense that's just going to go warp speed 1,000 miles an hour? What about an LSU? So I think while they're built to win in the Big Ten, in the elements, against a lot of these teams that don't have high-powered offenses, minus Ohio State. But I just don't know if that system translates to a college football playoff setting when you're trying to do that against more than one team that has nothing but five stars and future draft picks in front of you. And I think that's why last year's game in the Orange Bowl was so lopsided, because once they saw a defensive line that was made up of men that were going to be drafted and make millions of dollars in the next couple of years, they realized, oh crap, our technique is fine, but they're still bigger and faster and stronger and badder than us, and that's a problem. So higher floor but lower ceiling than some of the offenses like an Ohio State that can score 40 or 50 points pretty easily.
Does Ohio State score 40 or 50 points? It won't be easy, but do they work what they need to work? Because CJ Stroud, I think it's fair to say, is the Heisman front runner in a uninspiring Heisman field so far this season. That's a hell of a football team. And if Michigan wins one kind of way, Ohio State, maybe they win one kind of way too, but it does feel like they have more ways to win. At least they have more skill position players that can break a game open all by themselves. How do you see it all going down?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, last year, for all I said about how much Michigan dominated Ohio State, which they did, by the time the game was over, C.J. Stroud still threw for 394 yards and 4 touchdowns with no interceptions. So, you know, it wasn't like they completely snuffed Ohio State's offense. I'm very curious to see how they handle Marvin Harrison Jr. Because that kid is so good and is maybe the best receiver I've seen in person since I've been covering college football. I just think he's unbelievable and can do things with his body where even if you're in great position, it just doesn't matter. And CJ Stroud is so accurate. But the blitz package that Michigan has put together under first-year defensive coordinator Jesse Minter has been spectacular. Their third down defense is some of the best in the country because they are able to disguise their looks. They're able to bring corners and safeties. So I don't think they're going to have the type of sustained pressure that they had with Aiden Hutchinson and David Ojabo last year. The two of them combined for, I believe it was 19 or 20 quarterback pressures and four sacks. I don't think that's going to be the case. But what I think could happen is there could be two or three or four timely sacks that maybe the pressure isn't as consistent, but when it's needed, they can find a way to potentially get home. And, you know, if Blake Corum was 100% healthy going into this game, I would have picked Michigan to win. I still think they're a tougher team in the trenches physically, mentally than Ohio State. But without Corum, who, you know, is as close to a Heisman, a bona fide Heisman favorite as Michigan is probably ever going to have under Jim Harbaugh.
Right.
You know, he's coming in with this knee injury after he dropped out of the Illinois game last week. Nobody really knows what it is. Nobody really knows if he's going to be available or how effective he's going to be. But I don't think there's any way he's 100%. And without him being at 100%, I don't see how this offense can move the chains the way it's moved the chains all season. So I still think it'll be close, but I think without Corum, the scale definitely starts to tip in the favor of the home team.
It's number two versus number three, 9 a.m. tomorrow at Fox. Our number one, Michael Cohen, Fox Sports. Thanks so much for coming on, Mike. Enjoy the match today. Hopefully we have a lot to root for.
Yeah, absolutely. It was great to catch up with you, Dieter.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.